Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
Hello, I'm Fatma Sayed, sitting in for Jesse Brown this week. Joining me is an editor at the Toronto Star, Evie Kwong. Hi, Evie. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Hey, what's good?
We're going to get into some fun topics. To start, how are only people of color apparently worried about getting the COVID vaccine? And are journalists just exhausted and traumatized even more than they've ever been during this pandemic? We're going to get into that. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
This episode of Canada Land Shortcuts is brought to you by Mackenzie Brown, Robin Weeks, Ben Cullen, Elliot Fonarev, sorry, Elliot, Rebecca Rooney, Susan Corrigan, Kevin White, and Miles Forrester.
Hello, my name is Miles Forrester. I am a poet living in Toronto, and I listen to Canada Land because it gives structure to my week, and I learn about things that I probably won't hear anywhere else unless I go onto social media, which I really don't want to do.
Vaccine hesitancy continues to be a problem, especially in the Black community.
According to Statistics Canada, more than two-thirds of Black Canadians are reluctant to get a shot.
But money and goodwill can't overcome one of the biggest challenges, administering the vaccines in Indigenous communities.
Okay, Evie, we've been talking about vaccine hesitancy ever since we learned that vaccines need to be created to combat COVID-19. I was really interested to see a couple of comments this week on Twitter where I get most of my commentary. One was from Vicky Mochatma, the Queen, who said that Canada is so unwilling to deal with white supremacy that there have been two white riots this past week at Grace Life in Alberta and in Montreal. And yet we're still just talking about vaccine hesitancy among racialized people. These riots were people not wearing masks, protesting for the end of lockdowns, you know, saying that the pandemic isn't real. But most of the headlines when you Google vaccine hesitancy was about those among racialized communities. The other person who caught my attention on this topic is Pia Chattopadhyay, who said that we really need to stop racializing the conversation around vaccine hesitancy. She says there's anti-vaxxers in the white population, and she was really tired of every story being about people of color when it came to taking the vaccine. There's a larger question about the mainstream narrative and what it means for us to exclude white people from vaccine hesitancy. Evie, you did an amazing project. You literally got people and experts who have taken the vaccine or who wanted people to take the vaccine to speak in their own language and tell the audience why they should take the vaccine. Tell me why that was important for you and what was the thinking behind putting that together?
So the thing behind putting that together, it was important to get a neighborhood, like I'll call it like that, or your family friend or your daughter or someone you trust to kind of tell you in their language, you know, being representative, like when you see something, you can believe it. So I'll give an example. Some people we got there were from the Cantonese population, like in China, in the Chinese Canadian population in Canada. And it's like having that person advocate for you is going to do so much more than perhaps, you know, even government officials. The thing about the Vaccine Hesitancy Project I put together with people in different languages that represent different groups, whether they were Black or Indigenous or other people of color, was all about getting a friend or someone to give you a real account of why they took it. It obviously does help with, you know, dispelling people who might be a little bit nervous. You know, they're on the fence or wondering, you know, how does it feel right after? How does it work? So that was kind of the whole approach. When we talk about those comments that Vicky and Pia made, which I think are super valid because it seems as if the conversation and data and stories are like, well, guess what? The Chinese Canadian population is scared to get the vaccine, you know, or whatever, whatever. I get that. I think that's really annoying. I think the project that we did and the stuff that I'm doing going forward is a solution-based thing, not saying that there isn't vaccine hesitancy in our communities. There really is. Like, go on one WhatsApp group chat in my Chinese family freaking group, and it's just crazy rumors, like crazy amounts of things that needs to be addressed. That goes with a whole situation of not having enough media, have nowhere to access news, a distrust in systems. And when it comes to Black and Indigenous groups, it's way more historical. Whereas it's true, we're having crazy, you know, white alt-right riots right in Canada that is getting Fox News attention, that is being treated like it's a weird phenomenon, which it isn't, right? It's like, we know this happens on Facebook groups. We know this happens in other churches in smaller scales. Like, we know of big ones right now, that Alberta one. But it's like, that is an issue. That should have the same amount of criticism. I think the thing that we're exhausted by as people of color and racialized people is that, yes, vaccine hesitancy is a thing. We know, and we're going to do our best to get our information out there with a solution-based thing. Like, get someone to tell you what it was like, okay? That's a solution. It's not going to be the be-all, end-all. But don't just say, oh, you know, Black and Indigenous people, vaccine hesitancy. This is the numbers. This is the data. This is what we did. Okay, data is important, but do something about it, right? Have a solution. Don't just, like, report the fact that these marginalized communities that are suffering, obviously, the most from COVID aren't doing anything. It's not about that. We have never had a federal or a government response to really address that even from the beginning.
I love how nuanced your rant was, because it's true. Like, there are various different structural and institutional problems at play when it comes to, you know, the concept of vaccine hesitancy. Evie, what do you say to the people who think that a story like yours, where you actually go and get people to speak in their own language about why anyone should get the vaccine, might be feeding into this narrative that it is just among racialized groups that vaccine hesitancy exists?
I think that would be an odd way to see it, you know, and it's okay. I get people have their opinions, but the thing is, when I created this, you know, the videos themselves have the people speaking about why they would be, you know, hesitant, right? Like, the first video I put up was from an Indigenous VP of Reconciliation at Algonquin College. He said, you know, the decision was really difficult, seeing as our history has whatever. I don't even shy away from that. I didn't want to cut the part. It wasn't like an all let's all get the vaccine campaign. It wasn't a campaign. It was talking to real people about their real experience, whether they felt feverish after, whether they did. It was an observational piece. And the reason why we translated all in English is because, A, we know that media doesn't cover a lot of these populations. So I want them to understand what the problems are. You know, between me as a in the Chinese community, it's a way different situation of worry than it is for Indigenous people or Black people. There needs to be a targeted approach to each of these communities. I was speaking with Indigenous doctor Lisa Richardson, who was actually up north doing these really successful Indigenous vaccination clinics. And, you know, the whole thing is not about persuasion. It's about agency, you know. So if the person goes there, there's elders there. If you're in line and you're like, oh, my God, I feel so much regret, there are people there to help you. And if you want to leave that day and come back tomorrow, they allow that. That's what it was about, the agency. So when I was doing this piece, it was not about pushing this on, you know, and being like, it's all racialized people. It's just to show I'm a mostly white mainstream media audience, you know, the lived experience of these people and why there's a situation with that. Plus, in the piece, there was also, you know, people from Italian and Portuguese backgrounds that also face this too. Like, we don't talk about that. They are, you know, they're white, but they also have their own, you know, situations where they aren't getting enough information. Their grandmas can't understand that. So it was not just selectively for racialized groups. I think it's still important to address each of them in their own specific way and giving them each as much weight as another, because they're all really different. And now let's just talk about the conspiracy theorists, because to be honest, most of them are probably white. The people who are spreading these rumors, we have elected leaders like Roman Barber, like, you know, Baber, whatever his name is, like basically saying, oh, lockdown's done. We don't need the lockdown. Like, what are you talking about? I don't understand. Or like people, you know, at The Sun being like dictatorship as a front page. What does that say about, you know, the actual audience and the weight that they carry within this mostly white readership? I'm not going to say it's all white, but having collected data about who is vaccine hesitant just by race is completely incorrect to me. There's also religious things. There's also conspiracy theorists. A lot of the wellness naturopath people who are white, you know, a lot of them are the same people saying, I'm anti-vax, or I'm on the fence, or I'm vaccine hesitant. Where's the poll for those people? Like the wellness people. And we haven't even gotten the language to like be like, there's certain groups of people like that are, you know, from the white population that are vaccine hesitant or anti-vaxxers. Even in America, they got NASCAR drivers, right? And they were like, okay, if we can get the NASCAR drivers who are seen as superheroes to these people, basically say, hey, I got the vaccine, here's a video. Like, wouldn't that help? I think that would help a lot. I think there's a whole strategy behind that that we haven't thought about. And I feel like we are altogether need to cover the other part more, the conspiracy theorists, the wellness people, without giving them light and pride and like, this is their right. Like, this is not what we're talking about. We're talking about the same type of things. These people aren't getting the vaccine.
It's not a racialized problem. There is white vax resistors. and the problem is that every time there is a anti-vaxxer movement or protest or event of some kind, we call it a manifestation of a conspiracy, or we call the people there conspiracy theorists. We don't call them vaccine hesitant folks who need to be spoken to in a constructive way and educated and informed.
You know, that Toronto Sun front page dictatorship could be told by, in a workplace, by someone who reads it, a white person, to a Chinese colleague. Their Chinese colleague comes home, goes on WhatsApp, said, I heard like from the official mainstream newspaper, blah, blah, blah. So that's how it really rolls down. So let's not talk about just that.
No, you're right, because I've been seeing the same thing circle around in like WhatsApp groups as well, where people will cite like all kinds of just like headlines where they'll see like, oh, you know, lately it's been a lot of like, oh, AstraZeneca causes blood clots, I'm not going to get the vaccine. And then you have to like break it down and explain it to them. And then they still don't understand. And then you're left like saying, what words could I possibly use? Yeah. I'm not a medical expert. I'm just a journalist. I just read things. But what words do I even use to explain to this person who has so many fears across history? And this is, again, across communities. People have seen medical experiences go wrong. And when you have something as new as the vaccine, it scares them. And there's a history of that. You know, you mentioned Indigenous communities. Indigenous communities in Canada have largely been subjected to medical experimentations that have gone wrong and that have left generations skeptical of government medical assistance. Black people in America have suffered under the same kind of experimentation that has gone wrong. Mm-hmm. There is an inherent skepticism in all kinds of communities. But at the same time, I agree with you. You know, if you're in Calgary, talk to Calgarians in the way that they would understand.
Like pastors, get the pastors out there.
Yeah. If my imam can stand in like in the virtual like sermon and say like, hey, you all should get the vaccine. It's fine. I got the vaccine. Don't worry. God says you need to get a cure. Why can't a pastor in Calgary do that and address vaccine hesitancy? And why can't we as a government and as a society recruit those leaders that people listen to way more than you and me and get them to address it among their community? Why does it just have to be imams and, you know, the faith leaders and temples and stuff? It should also be pastors and church leaders and country singers in Canada.
Yeah. Like that would be the way. And unfortunately, like also as journalists who are journalists of color, also women, when people, the moment they see our face or even, you know, the thing we're sharing, they don't read the story. You know, I'm talking about certain populations, like here they go again, talking about the same racialized issue, blah, 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 blah. And then it gives this weird narrative, if you don't read it and really understand it, that oh, it's all the racialized people's fault. Like they won't get the vaccine. That is not what we're saying, right? Like that is not at all. It's just that from the get, the government has never had for some reason, I really think that they just went, okay, bought all the vaccines, supply. They didn't even put the human element in it being like, okay, this vaccine was developed in less than a year. Do you think people would get it and think they were like, oh, yeah, yeah, like for sure. Like, why wasn't that like one of the second things that you address, right? Like, yeah. Knowing that you have a population that is anti-vax, that population perhaps in Alberta, which we're seeing now, that is alt-right, that kind of blended together, you know, that has a distrust in systems as well, but in a different way. And right now we have to just see them as one, two weird instances or like phenomena. And it's not that. They happen all the time. Just go to one Facebook group. They don't know how to address these inequities, A, like they never have. And also B, like we need to figure out how to not glorify those white supremacist movements or the anti-vax or the lockdown thing.
More than that, we need to talk to them, right? I think it actually is a form of othering if we just celebrate like racialized communities and how they're combating vaccine hesitancy without recognizing that there is a huge community that is largely white that isn't doing anything about this. That, you know, totally. We're actively letting them go to the streets without masks and not get the vaccine and not care about the lockdown and not care about the pandemic. Like, by implicitly not recognizing how dangerous that is and then celebrating how well like Thorncliffe did by putting up a pop-up tent and literally vaccinating people across the street and, you know, inspiring them by numbers. Like if you see like a neighbor getting a vaccine, wouldn't you get the vaccine? Why isn't that happening in predominantly white communities? And why aren't we calling it out? So, you know, honestly, this is me calling it out. Seriously, I love that all the racialized communities are combating vaccine hesitancy. I know so many young brown folks and young Asian folks across Canada who have become vaccine doulas in spreading vaccine information. We have like so many Twitter accounts that are doing this on the count, mostly run by people of color. But I am legitimately on this podcast calling out all the white communities that are not even addressing it and asking journalists to go in there and be like, hey, what's wrong? What's the problem here? Because there's people of color and new immigrants who don't even have status who are trying to get the vaccine. And here you are, generations of Canadians who aren't even addressing it.
For sure. And I think that is so important. So get that pastor up there. Get that country music star.
This is really sad. I can't think of a single Canadian country singer.
I don't listen to that genre. So I can't speak to that.
Shania Twain. Can we just get Shania Twain to do a song about vaccine? Does she count?
She might be like too progressive for some people.
Evie, on this show, we like to duly note news that might have gone overlooked. What do you want to duly note this week?
What I want to duly note is the further investigation at the Grassy Narrows site. The Star did a further investigation. Sheila Wang, she's actually from YorkRegion.com and also helping us at Tourstar. But it was about basically how mine contracts have been going up, have been surging even throughout the pandemic. You know, it's like the first step for mining prospectors to maybe be able to get a sort of deal with the province, right? And so that's happening on Grassy Narrows land where we have not even excavated after, you know, years of this investigation and promises of excavating the alleged mercury dump sites, which the government has admitted saying, you know, there was mercury found in the soil. This is human rights. Like we're talking about drinking water, like eating fish, eating what's on their land. And that has already plagued them in terms of tremors and other issues and dying young, even, you know, when we talk to those people. And it's like, in a world when it wasn't so busy that people actually recognizing that even in a damn pandemic, this is not obviously, I don't see mining contracts as a priority. Maybe I don't know anything and I don't know anything about money, but like these people need to figure out why their water has been messed and, you know, feeling like they've been poisoned by mercury.
It's such an awful story. And I read that it's been 50 years since, you know, it was first exposed that mercury was being poured into the river at Grassy Narrows. And it's been 6 years since a worker confessed to dumping mercury in that land and nothing has been done. So definitely, definitely duly noted and a must-read story. Please find the capacity to care.
It's hard.
I have a completely like different and stupid story to duly note, but it is a very Fatima story. I want to highlight a story that Vice got about how the Canadian military is being notified when pilots spot UFOs in Canadian airspace.
Woo!
Of all the things that I thought would happen this year, that's not information I thought would ever be revealed.
That's actually sick.
I love it. I would actually like to know how many UFOs we've seen. The Vice report said that they've seen one over northern Manitoba that looked like an inexplicable bright light. before the sunrise on January 6, 2019.
Wow.
So I would like to know how many UFOs we've seen, where they're at, where they're going, whether we've made contact. You know, I need way more information. So if you work in the Canadian military and you're tracking UFOs, hit me up. DM me, please.
Will the aliens save us? They might save us.
I feel like after everything we've gone through this past year, aliens might be our only hope.
Duly noted.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope.
Evie, are you tired?
Hell yeah.
So. I am so tired. And I was struck by this piece by Erica Lenti in Maclean's this week, where she highlighted how her and her partner both work in journalism and have been working in a small apartment, as is the case with many people in Toronto. Yeah. And she talks about how she failed spectacularly at her therapist's suggestion to not talk about COVID-19 after 8 p.m. She started seeing her therapist when the pandemic first started, and it's sort of been a struggle ever since, according to the story. The part that got to me is she writes, and I'm quoting, "Our baseline of anxiety has risen because as journalists, we've seen some of the worst of humanity on an intimate level. We can't unsee it. Rather, we have to keep facing it even when this pandemic ends." Evie, how are you feeling? How are you coping? Because this Maclean story and the Twitter discourse and just the general discourse around it just tapped into some emotion that we're all feeling and not talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you, Fatima, you're definitely, I can only imagine how exhausted you are. I'm going to just say I'm also hella exhausted. And to be honest, my partner is an ICU nurse. So we are feeling the burnout. You know, we are talking about the individual cases, obviously not the names or the ages or whatever, but he comes home, gets on COD, Call of Duty, and just yells, and I'm like, go for it, while I'm working in the meeting, because I'm like, we live in a one-bedroom condo, right? And this is a fake one-bedroom, and I'm not going to even be mad about it. It is what it is, because, you know, everything's so expensive. I at least have a place to stay, but it's like a fake glass door with a bedroom. So right now, I'm recording. He just came off an overnight shift. He's trying to sleep, and I'm like, I'm sorry, I have to do this, right? Like, I have meetings after this, too. So I'm really happy about how we've been okay. Like, I actually feel really great, but it's like, yes, it's like I'm out here being like numbers. It's really annoying. Like more like shooting news, which is horrible. You know, just even this week, like I can't even keep up. There's so much stuff. And I feel like I have to keep up. I feel like I do. Whereas I also am lucky to have a therapist and to be able to, they don't give me the strict rule, don't talk after 8. I don't think that's possible for me. It's really unfortunate. But like my kitchen table is my work desk, right? everything that I write and think about COVID, about people, the deaths, about all that stuff is done where I'm going to eat dinner. And it always connects me back to that. The best thing I've been able to kind of do is go for a long ass walk. Like one of those people, I'm a walker now, you know, I count my steps because I have nothing else to do and I need to take my mind off stuff. But it doesn't mean that I'm on my walk, I'm not checking in on my partner being like, yo, are you okay in the ICU? Are you okay? Or it doesn't mean I'm not looking at the latest news on Twitter. I really still am, unfortunately. It's like kind of like I can't stop and it's not, it's such an unhealthy addiction. So what she's writing about being able to stop at 8, I'm like, that is not possible for me. Like it's only possible if I drink. Sorry, I take my weed pills. Like, it is what it is. I'm going to tell you what I do to really cope. And at the end of the day, it's still really hard. I try my best, but I have not figured it out. So, Fatima, if you have ideas.
I mean, I don't know. I'm lucky if I have 1 hour in the day where my brain can actually shut the news out. Like, that to me is a good day. If I can find 1 hour in the evening where I'm not thinking about the news, I'm not thinking about COVID, I'm watching something stupid, or I'm listening to something fun, or I'm talking to a friend and there's no COVID in that conversation. That to me is a good day at present. I remember last year when the pandemic started, I started taking screenshots of everything that was happening because I'm like, I feel like I need to record this in somehow and I'm too tired to like write it all down or create like a Google Doc or, you know, form my thoughts in some way. So I just started taking screenshots and it was just, it's so bad. It was like Australian wildfires, yeah. Pandemic, literally it's inescapable.
Yeah.
And as someone whose job, like both of our jobs is to relay information about what's happening in the world, there is too much happening in the world. Like my brain goes from pandemic crisis to climate crisis to housing crisis to financial crisis and then like back and then racism and there's police brutality and there's grassy narrows. And I'm just like, oh, make it stop. Please make it stop. And it doesn't stop. Like, I just wish as a world we could collectively take a day off or a week off even where it's like nothing's gonna happen today, we're all just gonna eat cake and, you know, have ice cream and go for nice like moments on the lake or something.
It's a lot
but for listeners who don't believe you and I, Evie, there is study to back up just how much journalists are struggling. In July 2020, Reuters did a survey of journalists. This study was cited by Erica Lenti as well, and it found that around 70% of journalists are suffering from some level of psychological distress. They found that journalists reporting on COVID showed signs of anxiety and depression. And even experienced reporters who work for large, well-funded media organizations were struggling to cope with all the demands of reporting on the pandemic. Like, I don't know if, for those of you who follow the news closely, news breaks at like odd times, like 9 p.m. and journalists are on it. And I'm like, how are you guys doing this?
I'm not trying to be lame AF, but honestly, like, I think you're part of that too. Like, you know, you say 9 p.m., but sometimes I see you breaking news that time. I'm not trying to be lame, but like, really, I think we really care. Like, the thing is, we know how inaccessible, especially, you know, for our communities, information is. I'm just like, how can I go to bed, you know, if I don't even just say this one damn thing? If the M5V people yesterday were able to sign up and suddenly at 9 p.m., oh, sorry, you can't. How am I going to go to bed being like, oh yeah, you guys can't actually anymore without even saying that? Like, I feel like a horrible person, and that's bad, right? Because it's like you're bringing in your whole life in it. And I think that's a thing that we'll always go through. A lot of journalists will feel that way for sure. And I think obviously have your own space and all that wellness stuff, of course. But even like, you know, you're supposed to be in a time of celebration. It's Ramadan, you know, like what the hell? Like, you're trying to celebrate. You're trying to have a great time. It's like, it's impossible. Yeah. So like, I'm sorry, you can only have one duly noted thing, but there's amazing stories about Ramadan that are happening right now that are out there. But unfortunately, there's so much other stuff that piles on. Yes, I am a journalist that has depression and anxiety more so after this, for sure. Like, I have definitely aged. My vision is terrible. I don't know what the hell happened. I'm like, I need to get an eye test, but is it safe? And like, my brain is just rattling on and on, just constant. And then, you know, the best things, actually the best remedies that make me feel human are my non-journalist friends, which I love to the damn core. Cause I'm like, did you know what happened today? It was like this. And like, we should care about this. And they're like, shut the fuck up. Like, they're like, be quiet.
I have friends who just send me animal videos on Instagram, and honestly bless them, because I need that content so much in my life. Like, I just need stupid content that has nothing to do with the news.
Yes.
Because I don't know about you, but I feel like, and again, the Reuters study proved this, that we're working just all the time.
Yeah.
Even though we're at home, it's like no longer like nine to five. We're not logging off. We're always on. And I like it's the third day of Ramadan. Like I wake up at like 4:30 a.m. to eat.
Yeah.
Right. I will check Twitter before going to sleep. And I realized I was doing this today and I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I have to not check Twitter at 5 a.m. to make sure that I didn't miss anything while I was sleeping. And then I think what also makes it worse is that there's still people who don't believe media, right? Like, we were talking about vaccine hesitancy today. There's people who think that we're lying to them, like that media is, you know, fake news and whatever. And I was really struck when Amber Brecken, who's this Edmonton-based photojournalist, she was retweeting a conversation with the photojournalist of the year assigned by News Photographers Association of Canada. His name is Darren Calabrese, and he's based in Halifax. And he admitted on an Instagram live conversation that he is not doing well, just explicitly. He said that he was honored to have been named Canada's photojournalist of the year, but he said it's been the hardest professional and personal year of his life. And he said he didn't know if he'll have a career at the end of it. He won in part for photographing the Nova Scotia shooting that happened last year. And he described it as going out on the highway chasing after a murderer dressed as an RCMP all on his own. His wife was crying in the kitchen. He was scared, but he felt that financially he had to do it.
Yeah.
He had to go get this photo. And it was his responsibility to cover this huge moment in his region. Amber Brecken also tweeted him saying that he got a $350 day rate for 12 hours and 20 crime scenes, which is nuts. I don't know where journalism's going. I just know we're all really tired and I'm desperately hoping we survive this.
No, I agree. And that whole people not believing we're part of a bigger narrative, whether or not you trust mainstream media, like, you know, it is hard. And the thing is, obviously, there's different types within it. I've always grown up as a person who trusts people over the organizations, right? And it's not, I'm not just talking about me, I'm talking about almost everything, right? Like, there's people that I, you know, I wish there was a page where I could subscribe to Fatima stuff. That's it, you know, like whatever, you know, without any strings attached to anything else. And I think, to be honest, in conversations, you know, on the audience team, I also do a lot of listening about what people want to see. And for the younger generation and millennials, like, they don't trust a whole organization, which I think is fair because they grew up in a situation where they're like seeing, I mean, live time right now, like the government's kind of failed them. There might be certain people they really like there that advocate for what they like, but they don't just trust. They're not like, I'm a left, I'm a right. They're just like, I'm a person. I trust who I trust and I'm whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really how, in the way I see it, is actually kind of it's a cool thing because I think people trust people more, right? Like you trust the fact that I'm me. And so that is the only way I think they can see you separate, you know, like your fake news, like you just work with the government or whoever, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, when I hear that, I'm like, damn, man, I'm not doing my job right.
Evie, you're churning out content. You're editing opinion columns from people of color who don't often get a chance to be in Canada's largest paper. You're creating TikToks. You're doing socials for Toronto Star. Like, it's a lot on your plate. And then there are so many people who I've seen attack you for being fake news as well. And I'm just like, seriously, do you not see the amount of work she's putting out to try and communicate with everyone in ways they'll understand?
Oh, I mean, we already know, like every time I put up a TikTok, like the man who has used dog shampoo, like I already called it out. I don't really care. Like, he's like, how is this real news? And I'm like, come on, like, really? Come on, find something else. Like, you know what? Maybe it's not for you because, like, you know, you're used to seeing in a certain way, but this is changing. If you really want to keep up with the future, and to be honest, like, yes, there's obviously, you know, you can't just paint a whole generation as someone who's great, but the activity of Gen Z and like being so action oriented, you know, they led protests. And when I was thinking back when I was in high school, I was like, what the fuck was I doing? I was being a dumbass, like not caring.
Well, that's the thing. There's the world has changed, right? There's so much more to care about. And just like, I feel bad some days that I, you know, like the other day I was thinking, I was reading something on the Rohingya refugees and I was like, oh my God, I haven't shared this in a long time. But if I share this, will anyone even care? Yeah. Like, do they realize that this is still happening? And it's just like a moment in my head where I'm just like, oh my God, I need someone to care about this, but I don't think anyone has the capacity to care about this, but I care about it, but I'm also tired. And it's just like an inferno, as you said, it's crazy.
At the end of the day, you're still a person. Like, that's like, I'm not a robot. I'm not going to not cry and feel sad or feel incredible anger. And so I think what the younger generations really want is that transparency. You know, that's what I've always tried to do with the Star. When I picked it up, it wasn't like that on socials, but it's like nowadays we interact when we can with our other reporters through GIFs. Like, no matter how weird that is, I want you to know there's a human behind this, right? Like, I want you to know I'm making intentional decisions when I social things, right? And we get some stuff wrong, and our team is pretty big, so we never know. But it's like at the end of the day, being real, knowing that things are exhausting, that's when people are like, I can relate to this person because I'm also exhausted. Like, of course, like, don't, it doesn't have to be such a rigid thing. And you know, you're not going on the live to, like, you know, talk shit about the workplace. You're just like, yo, I'm so tired. And I think if you just say that, people would trust the news more. I don't know what it is. It's like, it doesn't need to be a silent place.
I think that my message to people who aren't journalists who might be listening to this is just be nice to them, because they're dealing with a lot. Not only are they reporting on every shitty, crazy, complicated, confusing thing that's happening in the past year and a half or whatever, but they're also dealing with institutions that aren't exactly being accessible with their information. They're trying to disseminate information to so many different kinds of communities to try and get important information. It's a public service, and they're doing it all at home with family members who are also struggling with their own problems, with their own experiences with COVID-19 and racism and whatever else is going on in the world. And yeah, we're all tired, but we found time to do this podcast, so you're welcome.
Exactly. You're welcome. No, I'm really happy I got to talk. It takes me out of, like, this makes me feel human. It takes me out of my element, right? Like, I mean, I'm in my element, but I'm like, oh yeah, I'm still Evie, like the weird person who has emotion. So thanks, guys. It was cathartic.
Okay, well, that's your Canada Land shortcuts. You can email Jesse about it at jesse@canadaland.com. He reads everything you send him. I'm Fatma Sayed. You can find me on Twitter at Fatma B. Sayed. Canada Land's on Twitter at Canada Land. Evie, where can people find you?
At Evie Stadium on everything. I keep it easy.
Our website is canadaland.com. This episode was produced by Tiffany Lamb with additional production by Kevin Sexton. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do and you'd like to receive ad-free versions of all our podcasts, please support us by hitting the link in our show notes or go to canadaland.com/join. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.